Come up on the tight wire.
I'm in Studio B, sitting across from my good friend, Benjamin Alida Sines.
And I'm in Studio B, too, and I'm sitting across from my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
Now, wait a minute. Are you in Studio B, too, or Studio B also? Welcome to Words on a Wire. Today, our guest is Raphael Dagold, whose new book of poems, Bastard Heart, just came out with Silverfish Review Press, and it is the winner of the Gerald Cable Book Award.
He's a very, very fine poet, and we're very lucky to have him on our show. And he's also went to grad school with Daniel.
Right, University of Oregon. We went to the same class, and so I've known this guy for years, but it's nice to reconnect once he got this book published, and it was quite a struggle, and we'll ask him a little bit about that. Also, for Poetic License, we have Antonina Paris Yarbrough, and she's going to talk a little bit about reading and patience and how discovering great books can just be an amazing experience. I'm looking forward to that. She's very intelligent, brilliant young woman, and she also happens to be the daughter of Steve Yarbrough, who is the fiction writer.
Nice.
And he was my very first fiction writing teacher at Fresno State. Now he's at Boston University, or Emerson, excuse me. And she's gone on to get a PhD and to become a brilliant English professor. So
6 degrees of separation.
Yeah, and you know what's really weird? I remember the last time I saw her, she was probably 7 years old. I was at a party at Steve Yarbrough's house, and here's his little daughter's running around. It was so cute. And now she's
a poet.
A genius.
Nice.
So we're glad to have her. So stick around. Ben, we were going to talk a little bit about the Penn Hemingway Award. You were a judge this year. And can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a judge? I mean, they send you like, what, a box of books and you have to read them all?
No, I didn't have to read them all. Well, this is the way they do it at the Penn Hemingway. They send each judge. There was three of us. Scott Turow was one judge.
Popular fiction writer.
Yes, he writes mystery novels. Legal mystery novels. He's an excellent writer. He's an ex-Stegner fellow as well.
Oh, wow.
The other judge was Indira Ganem. And we're all fiction writers, and we all have very different tastes, and our writing is very different. And I must say that my two colleagues were very generous and collegial. It was very difficult to make our final judgments. We each got 35 books, and then we pushed our own books forward, and then I got their books. And then from the top, say, 12 books that we pushed forward for each, then we chose six.
Wow.
And then we had to pick one winner. The eventual winner was We Need New Names by No Violet Bulawayo. It's a phenomenal book. It's a phenomenal book. And all the books were phenomenal. There was two honor books. One of them was entitled The Residue Years, and then the other one was titled The Old Priest and Other Stories. And it was just an amazing journey. And when people lament the state of American fiction, I'm going to tell you, they don't know what they're talking about.
They're not paying attention.
They're
Absolutely.
Not paying attention. There's great books out there, really, really great books. So many that I'd like to recommend, perhaps in a future show. But I just wanted to say that even though it was a lot of work and I already have a really busy schedule, it was a great privilege to be one of the judges and to read so many books by so many fine young writers.
Right. I also think that there are so many brilliant young writers today, probably more than there have ever been, which makes sense because of the proliferation of the MFA culture and the MFA programs. This year I was judged for the AWP Intro Awards in Fiction, and they sent me in a giant box full of stories. I don't even know how many stories there were, and it was so hard to eliminate stories. I mean, some were easier than others, but it was so hard to eliminate them because they were, I would say, 80% of them were just amazing. And I'm thinking, wow, these people are going to be publishing books in 5 years. And yeah, I don't think fiction is suffering, that's for sure.
Right. So, and it really helps our art to be readers.
Right. And I think also that the better people are and the more great writing out there, the more it challenges other writers to be better.
Exactly.
And so I think we're going to do pretty good.
Long live books.
Ahua!
Long live literary culture.
And long live the Penn Hemingway Award, which is for a first book of fiction. Isn't that right?
Yes, it is.
Well, we're going to have to get those finalists and the winner on the show.
We will do that. We will absolutely do that. And I'm already prepared.
Stick around, and we will talk to Raphael Dagold, author of Bastard Heart.
Stay tuned. Raphael Dagold is the author of a poetry collection entitled Bastard Heart, the winner of the 2012 Gerald Cable Book Award. He was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland. His poems, fables, and photographs have appeared in Frank, Northwest Review, Born, Western Humanities Review, Two Girls Review, and other publications. He has taught writing and literature at the University of Utah, Lewis and Clark College, and other institutions, and has won fellowships and award from the UCross Foundation, Oregon Literary Arts, and the Association of Writers and Writing Programs. Raphael, welcome to our show, Words on a Wire.
Hey, thank you so much. I'm really excited to be on the show.
Congratulations on your book, Bastard Heart. Tell us a little bit about how this book came about.
Oh, sure. Well, I'll tell you, it was a long time in coming, really. A few of the poems in the book were written as long as, I think, about almost 20 years ago, actually. I had a first manuscript with the title Carbon that I was sending out for a while, and then eventually I gave up on that. I felt that a lot of the poems in that book were, I don't know, maybe apprentice poems, to put it that way.
Apprentice poems.
And then, apprentice poems. Yeah, it sounds better than, you know, just bad poems, you know, right? And a few years passed, and I was still, you know, writing new poems, and eventually I just said, well, you know, really, I've got this whole set of new poems, and I took out what I thought were the best poems from the first manuscript and made this new one. You know, and I was aware that there were certain themes or strains, veins, you know, running through the new book and kind of sets of ideas, and that it seemed to be a cohesive whole if I were to put it into the right order. So that's kind of how the book came to be in a short way.
I have a couple of questions. First of all, the idea of a bastard heart. How did that enter your imagination?
I have a couple of different ways to answer that. One is through the language. I mean, that is, well, first of all, to say that the title of the book is the title of one of the poems in the book.
Yes.
And that's how it became the title of the whole collection. But when I was writing that first poem, I mean, that poem with the title Bastard Heart, it didn't have a title yet. And I got to a line where the poem is saying, you know, why these birds are doing this, why these birds are doing that, is anybody's bastard heart to fill a mouth? And it was like, well, where did that phrasing come from? And it's like, you know, is anybody's guess? But the way that I thought about it is anybody's bastard heart? You know, and I guess, you know, because the poem is about unknowing in a lot of ways and the feeling things out. So I couldn't really tell you exactly where that phrase came from, but it was, you know, out of guilt and anger, but it entered through the language. That is, that phrase is anybody's guess, you know, yeah. But then it just became, for some reason, as I wrote it, as anybody's bastard heart.
Well, it seems so right, though. And you have a thing for blackbirds. Could you talk about that? They appear in several of your poems.
13 times, I think.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I stole the whole idea from that other poet.
Right, yeah.
Well, it's not like I had an obsession with blackbirds and then decided to write some poems about blackbirds, because there's three poems, Bastard Heart, Tree Heart, and Dirt Heart, and that was kind of in my mind anyway, anchor the book, and they're all about blackbirds. But it came up from a very, very specific scene. I spent a month in Wyoming at the UCross Foundation a number of years ago to write for a month, and where my studio was, there was a tree across the road, the dirt road, a big tree that just filled up with these birds, these blackbirds. And they would collect there, the whole flock of them, get louder and louder, and then they would start to move across the road down into this field of grain that was a field of millet. And after leaving there, that just stuck with me, because they would do it every single day. And so I started writing that poem, Bastard Heart, really simply to describe those birds as clearly as I could, but then knowing that there were some emotional things, personal things going on in my life, that was driving me to have that obsession and that particular view of the birds. So it came out of that, and I had the sense that I was writing more than one poem when I started that first one, so it became a series of three.
We're talking to Raphael Dagold, author of Bastard Heart, which just came out with Silverfish Review Press. Raphael, we went to graduate school together at the University of Oregon. I've known you, so therefore, for many years, although we basically are just connecting right now. But One of the things I really admire about you, in fact, you are one of my literary heroes, because this book is a result of hard work and persistence and patience and patience and patience. It was a while before you got this book out after graduate school, and it must have been quite a struggle to do it. But you did it. I mean, you did it. You didn't give up. And I'm always telling my students, if you don't give up and you have the talent, and clearly it's a beautiful book. I mean, you have this amazing gift. But were there ever any points where you just thought to yourself, you know what, the heck with this, I'm going to do something else?
No, it never occurred to me to say it that way, to say the heck with it and I'm going to do something else. You know, I always believed somewhere that I would eventually have a book, and I at bottom believe that it was worth it for me to continue to write poems. But that isn't to say that there weren't times of despair and thinking, you know, that negative self-talk that we all have at some time or another, where I thought, you know, is this really going to happen? Is my work really worthwhile at all? You know, those kinds of questionings. But I always came back to, you know, yes, it is worthwhile, and yes, eventually I will have a book, even though there were times of thinking, oh, man, it's not going to happen this year, it's not going to happen in the next 5 years, why hasn't it happened yet? You know,
right.
All of that. I mean, I'm certainly good at whipping myself, but at bottom, I never gave up.
Yeah, it's really difficult to have a colleague like Benjamin Alida Science, because he's always winning all these prizes and selling novels to Simon & Schuster. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it's kind of depressing just being next to him.
Yes, exactly.
But exactly. One of the things that you have in what you just said is, even though you would say things like it's not going to happen this year or it may not happen in the next 2 years, you know, which it almost allows it not to happen, you still kept that image that it was going to happen, and you still work towards that. And that's, you know, I'm positive that has a lot to do with why it did eventually happen, because you held that image and you didn't give it up. Let me ask you, what's your image for a second book?
Well, I've got one in the works. It's maybe half done, depending on how you look at it. And I hope to
half empty or half full.
Yeah,
is that the dichotomy you're
full? right. Well, yeah, like it's either a book that's on its way to being a cohesive whole very soon, or it's a book that's just a collection of tatters that might disappear at any moment. but I hope it's the former, and I hope to have it done sometime in the next year, and to be sending it out then. It's all poems that I've written just in the last few years, and I'm really excited about it, actually. There's some exciting new territory in terms of style that I'm working with, including a web-based project that I'm hoping to somehow have a good way to link to something within the pages of the paper book.
That kind of patience you were talking about earlier is really interesting to me. Like, you just knew it was going to happen, and you just kept writing and reworking and just that faith. Because there was a time when I did say that to myself. My career's in the toilet, just flush and just move on, just move on. And but after I said that, I wrote my best novel. What in my opinion is my best novel.
Which one was that?
In Perfect Light.
Mm. I remember that period that you were going through too.
Yeah, and it got published, and it was, you know, it changed the shape of my career. But maybe I needed to say that to myself. Maybe you didn't need to say that to yourself.
Yeah, no. When I think about particular poems, like including that poem, the title poem, "Bastard Heart," when I wrote that poem, I was just like, you know, I have no idea where this is going, whether it's publishable, whether it's going to be publishable. But I just need to try some stuff out. And I remember when I was writing it, I was thinking, I'm going to write a magic spell, is the way that I thought about it.
Right.
And you know, just this arcane, weird stuff on the page, and it became, you know, for me, one of my favorite poems. I mean, that's one of the reasons it's the title poem. But I would say that too, to keep that faith, I need to say that one of the things that kind of kept me in it, in my heart, was things like working in a Writers in the Schools program, which I did for 9 years in Portland.
Good for you.
Yeah, it was just really terrific. Because, I mean, so that meant that, you know, every year for, you know, either 3 weeks or for a full semester once a week, depending on how they arranged it, I would be in there going into the high school classrooms and talking to kids about poetry and helping them to write. And that just kind of kept me fresh, I guess, you know, to see that, you know, here were these 9th graders, 10th graders, you know, seniors, you know, writing their poems. I mean, so many high school kids write. And that just kept the faith for myself, I think, and other things, including, say, adjuncting at a community college, which I also did for a number of years, and teaching composition and creative writing. So things like that really did keep my own faith up.
In putting this book together, Bastard Heart, over the years, or, you know, however long it took you to put together, and once you finally had what, you know, essentially became, you know, the book that we're holding in our hands right now, mm-hmm. were there certain themes that emerged from poem to poem, links and connections that surprised you?
Well, yeah. It's interesting because, to sort of work backwards on that question, I find now that it is, when it is this physical product that I'm holding in my hand right here, that when I open it up and I see, oh, look, there's this poem on the left-hand facing page, and then it moves on to this other poem. Oh, that, how interesting. What kind of, you know, resonances are there? That is, in other words, this book surprises me, even though I very deliberately right. put it together. But now it's a different thing somehow in the you know, bound pages. So it continues to surprise me, but at the same time, when I did put it together, and I remember spreading out the pages on a big coffee table and putting it together, there were certain, you know, I was aware that there were certain themes such as Jewish family history,
right.
Jewish global history. There were, you know, childhood poems. There were, you know, mother poems, father poems. There were dissolution of marriage poems. And I did consider making sections of the book, but that never really made sense to me because, you know, say a poem that has to do with Jewish family history moves you know, quickly to Jewish global history, and it also is a childhood poem, it's also a general family poem, et cetera. And so I tried to put the poems together where kind of facets of those, I don't know, crystals would touch at different points and move through the book in a more interesting way than trying to, you know, glob, you know, big headings together.
I just really thought that the history that came out, like, again, like I said, just so organically, was fascinating, and it really added another dimension and depth to the book. But to me, the power of the book is coming from these personal experiences. Like, one of my favorite poems, you know, Ben's is, his favorite poem in the book is Elements, but my favorite poem in the book is the one about the apple core, learning to eat apples. I think that's
right.
It's incredibly beautiful. And that image of the apple and the father and all that mm-hmm. just seems to come out so naturally.
Right. Do you have a favorite poem in the collection?
Oh, do I have a favorite poem? Oh, man.
Or do you love all your children?
These are all my children. I don't want to leave any of them behind. I think I always come back to the title poem, Bastard Heart. I think that part of the reason that it's continues to come up as my favorite poem, it's not always my favorite poem, but it always comes back to it, is because it's difficult for me to understand. You know, I wrote it to try to figure out some stuff, and I'm still figuring out that same stuff, you know, and I read it, and I don't quite get it myself, and I think that that's one of the reasons it's my favorite.
Would you like to read that poem for us?
Well, I would if you'd like to, but I'll go with the one that you wanted me to read.
Well, I would want the apple core, so we're going to have to fight about this. But it's got to be among the three.
I'll go with the one that Benjamin wanted me to read, New Elements.
Yeah, all right. Great. Whatever. I'm kidding.
I love you, Raphael.
All right. I love you, too. There's an epigram. New Elements. Old Jewish Cemetery, Prague. For lack of space, this cemetery has 12 layers of burials. With each successive layer, the gravestones have been moved to the new layer of soil. The synagogue beside the cemetery has been turned into a memorial for Jewish victims of the Holocaust, with tens of thousands of Czech names printed on the interior walls. The site is visited by hundreds of tourists each day. New Elements. Why not start with the dead layers? Their stones pushed up, like tongues tasting the air of two halves of the century. They are bringing news to their damp apartments, They are banging brooms on the ceiling of loud neighbors arguing late ideas of new forms of darkness. The Kabbalists are testing relativity against the charts of an endless alphabet. They are breathing the faint residue of new arrivals to the periodic table, rearranging their circular formulae accordingly. In Pincus Synagogue, beside the stones, the walls of names have been speaking for years, learning language without bodies. It takes time for their sounds to travel the short space, to the tongues leaning on each other in the soft grass, like stars gone out centuries ago, whose light makes shadows during nights of a thin moon. The dead in their apartments listen. They murmur among themselves. They exclaim back and forth various ways to explain to the names their meaning. They are no squabbling crowd of pressed bones. They say, "We will birth the future in your name." They say, "We will give you our God and your abandonment." They say, "We will continue with our work." Each name, the name of God. Each letter, the wind of the Lord. Each bone, the balance of the everlasting. Each particle of dirt, the Almighty.
That was lovely. That's a beautiful poem, and you read beautifully, by the way.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
We've been talking to Raphael Dagold. Check out his new prize-winning book of poems, Bastard Heart. Raphael, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much. It's been terrific.
My name is Antonina Perez Yarbrough, and I'm originally from California, but right after finishing college, I moved to Poland and lived there as a teacher for 3 years. I came back to the States just a year and a half ago to do a master's degree in English at Boston University, and now I'm teaching English as a second language at the New England School of English. And in my spare time, I've begun to really enjoy writing blog posts. The post I'm going to read today is about a book that I recently read after trying to read it last year and not managing to get through it. And as I managed to finish it this time, I was thinking about why it was I originally didn't want to read the book. So this piece is called Poof, the Doll, and the Internet. Studies have shown that regular internet access has decreased our ability to concentrate for long periods of time. Over the past few years, this inability to focus has become painfully clear. If I sit down to watch a movie, I will inevitably get up to make myself some tea, play with my cats, or paint my nails. It's not that I don't enjoy the movie, it's just that there are so many other things I could also be doing. What has been even worse for me than the occasional movie distraction has been my own tendency to read shorter books because I know they won't take up as much time. There's certainly nothing wrong with reading short books, of course. What I do think is a problem, however, is refusing to read longer books because they take up too much time. And this was the trap into which I almost fell. I almost missed reading one of the most incredible books I've ever come across, all because it was 705 pages. Last year, I tried to read Bolesław Prus's The Doll on my mother's recommendation. I got about 70 pages in and then decided I didn't like it enough to lug it back and forth from the MLA conference. This year, I decided to try it again. I started back at the beginning and again found myself uninterested and working very hard to follow the chronology. One day, I decided I would read for an hour more, and if I still wasn't interested, I'd give the book up once and for all. I didn't think I was ready for a 700-page commitment. That day, after another chapter or two of exposition, I suddenly found myself thrust into the middle of Wokulski's tragic preoccupation with the icy Isabella, and then I couldn't stop reading. Bolesław Prus is considered to be the master of Polish realism, and his style has been compared to Balzac's, while his all-encompassing view of society in the 19th century is considered as skillful as Tolstoy's in Anna Karenina. High praise for a book that too few readers have heard of. Part of what I find fascinating about Proust's novel is that he presents characters that manage to be interesting without being idealized. In The Doll, Okulski falls in love with the beautiful Isabella without even knowing her. She, in turn, is shallow and selfish. And yet I continually found myself hoping that each of them would somehow have a happy ending. What makes both Okulski and Isabella, neither of them particularly prototypical protagonists, so fascinating is how painfully a product of their socio-historical context they are. Okulski has worked his way up the social ladder by making millions in trade with Russian merchants, but he never quite becomes a part of the highest circles. Isabella may be unkind and selfish, but likewise, she was born into an inescapable ideology, which, in her case, values beautiful women with sizable dowries. Her father's bankruptcy leaves her few choices, as most of her suitors abandon her. Even Okulski, who is willing to do almost anything for her, falls in love with her at a distance because of her beauty, and then is disappointed to discover the angelic face masks a contemptuous soul. What makes The Doll bleak in the end is that neither of the two principal characters manages to escape their unjust world. Even more wonderful than the tragic story of Okulski and Isabella, however, is the portrait of Warsaw society as a whole. Each of the minor characters is beautifully detailed, and no character is left without a personality. There is the old clerk, Zhetsky, who worships Napoleon, all the Napoleons, and is fascinated with politics, or P, as he surreptitiously refers to the subject in his journal. The Baroness Krzyzowska is the closest thing to a villain the novel has, and she manages to be realistically horrible while also being buffoonish. Her battles with the socialist students are endlessly riotous, and her persecution of the poor Mrs. Stavska causes some genuinely anxious moments. The Baron's ridiculous duel with Okulski and the increasing economic success of Schlangbaum also provide clear pictures of this world in which Okulski and Isabella find themselves trapped. After I finished the book, I realized how silly it would have been not to read it just because it was long. When I was younger, it seemed perfectly normal for a book to spend some time providing background. But nowadays, we all want instant gratification. If a book isn't captivating by the end of the first page, it's not worth our time. No wonder so many young authors find themselves drawn to writing memoirs about drug addiction or outlandish murder stories. They know they have only seconds to get their readers' attention and keep it. After I read the first paragraph of Gillian Flynn's Dark Places, in which she manages to drop the words blood, murders, and dead sisters, I couldn't imagine putting the book down. And it was an entertaining read, all right, but it was no proof. And yet I almost gave up on this classic because it took a few chapters to get to the real meat of the story. Are we destined eventually to stop reading the greatest works of literature all because they're long and slow and meandering? I hope not. For Words on the Wire, I'm Antonina Perez-Yarbrough.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
And thank you, Raphael Dogold, for sharing that lovely poem and for talking about your book, Bastard Heart. And also, we'd like to thank Antonina Perez-Yarbrough for her wonderful poetic license. It really causes us to think about slowing down when we're reading books.
And let's not forget to thank our brilliant producer, Norma Martinez. And she can boss me around any day of the
Absolutely.
Week.
Absolutely. You know, it's something about the way she bosses us around that makes it okay.
So thank you for listening. Stay tuned next week for another edition of Words on a Wire. And remember,
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alita Sines.
The next book you read
will save your life.